Welcome to Book It, a biweekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
My name is Jill.
And my name is Michael.
Catch us every other Wednesday talking about books, publishing, indie bookstores, chatting with authors, and so much more.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Book It Pod for more Book It content.
Want to read something you heard about on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookItPod.
We want to give a huge shout out to today's sponsor, Gay Shorts, which is a limited series Pride Month podcast featuring LGBTQ+ stories, but more on them later.
Hi, Michael.
How's it going, Jill?
We have had an exciting morning here.
Oh, tell me.
So I was upstairs getting ready in my room. Yeah. And I hear like a commotion and like loud kid noises, but like more loud than usual. Like, what's going on? And Penny runs in my room. She's like, Penny has the best bedhead you've ever seen. It's glorious and humongous. And she walks in with her giant bedhead. She's like half dressed. And she says, "One of the cats crawled into the floor."
What?
So, as our listeners know, I'm on the tail end. I hear there's only 2 weeks to go of whole house renovation, which during a pandemic has involved like plastic sheeting.
Yes.
And double like masking. Zones of containment, the whole nine yards. We foster cats. We work with a shelter and they come here for sometimes medication or sometimes socialization. We currently have two cats that were rescued from a hoarding situation. Yesterday, one of them broke out of wherever it had been. It was scared. And the first thing it saw to dart into was the underneath flap of the construction plastic. And from there, the next best hiding place, because that space has been gutted, there's nowhere to hide, was in the air duct under the floor. So the kids were like,
Sure.
The contractors had arrived. Mark's on a work call. I'm like, all right, okay. So Josh, the contractor, and I are trying to figure out like how we're going to get this cat out of the ceiling of the first floor, the floor of the second floor.
Now, was this the one that likes you or doesn't like you?
So we thought it was the one that hates us, but it turned out to be the other one.
Okay, good.
It involved us removing all the can lights from our living room on the first floor to like haul this cat's fat butt out of the ceiling because we could not get it to go back out the hole that it came in. It was like a 45-minute adventure. It was a thing.
We have been chatting now for a couple of hours. I cannot believe you didn't tell me this already. You were so calm this morning.
It was bonkers. Just absolutely crazy. And we tried everything. We like tried luring him out with treats and we opened cans of wet food. And the Josh had this idea to play cat noises and he kind of perked up and listened to him, but was like, "No, I'm good in here." Like,
right.
I don't know why you think I'm like, it's dark. It's I've got a space here. I'm chilling in this air duct. I don't know what your problem is.
Yeah. I'm fine.
Right. And Josh was like, "I need to set the bathtub down and I don't want him to be sealed in your floor."
That
and I was
is like, a good point.
Yeah, I feel like trapping a cat to die in my floor is a bad plan.
Yeah, you would definitely not get to foster again.
At the least. And then the kids are like, "Don't kill Bill." Oh. The cat's name is Bill Gates. "Don't kill Bill Gates."
That's going to be actually without you saying that that's the cat's name, that I'm just going to make that the soundbite we put all over social media.
Exactly.
Your kids are very concerned about Bill Gates.
My kids are very, yes. And I was like, oh my gosh. And before we managed to get the cat out of the ceiling, the kids had to go to school. So I ran them up to school. And the whole time I'm thinking like, what the teachers at school must think. I mean, because my kids have no shame. They will tell any story. Absolutely. And I hear back some of what they say that's like mostly right, but maybe not quite. And I'm often horrified. So if any of the staff or faculty at Mercer are listening, no cats were killed in the making of this episode.
Yes.
To my knowledge, Bill Gates is living a long and happy life. So I have no segue. But other than that was wild, and so was talking to Robert Jones Jr.
That is terrible, Jill.
It really was. But I did love talking to him. I'm excited. Oh my gosh.
One of the best. I cannot wait for our listeners to hear this. If you are a returning listener, you know that last episode we talked about our book club pick, which was The Prophets. And as is tradition at Book It, whatever our book club pick is, we have had the opportunity to talk to its author. And this was just such an unbelievable conversation. And I have yet again made a new friend, whether or not they know it.
Yes. Yes, I wanted to be like, so, like, can we have a group text?
Yes.
Are you ever in Cincinnati? Would you like to hang out?
Yes. It'll happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've decided.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you read The Prophets with us, please enjoy this interview. And if you haven't had the time yet to read The Prophets, it's a little bit spoiler alert, but I think you'll be fine. So sit back and enjoy this conversation with Robert Jones Jr. Today's sponsor wants to celebrate all LGBTQ plus stories that are out there in the world. Gay Shorts is a limited series Pride Month podcast featuring LGBTQ plus stories and conversations hosted, produced, and edited by Madeline Call at Honeysuckler Productions, who we are obsessed with over here on Book It because she is our amazing producer. Gay Shorts is my new favorite podcast, hands down, which is saying something because I notoriously hate wearing shorts. All month long during Pride, a different person from the LGBTQ plus community reads something they wrote about their experience as a queer person. And then afterwards, that person and Maddie have a conversation about it. I have been loving listening to Gay Shorts. I was actually featured on the first episode, but since then there have been three more episodes, and I have learned so much. Even within my own community, Gay Shorts has taught me that all of our experiences are unique and special, and that no matter what, we deserve love, respect, and support. You absolutely have to go listen to it right now. You can listen to Gay Shorts wherever podcasts are streamed, and you can go follow Gay Shorts on Instagram at Gay Shorts Pod.
We are so excited today to be joined by Robert Jones Jr. He is the author of our second book club pick, The Prophets. Robert Jones Jr. was born and raised in New York City. He received his BFA in creative writing with honors and an MFA in fiction from Brooklyn College. He has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Essence, The Feminist Wire. He's the creator of a social justice community, Son of Baldwin, and was featured in T Magazine's cover story, Black Writers of Our Time. The Prophets is his debut novel, which seems crazy because you're going to love it. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much for having me. It is such a pleasure to be here.
We are so excited to talk with you today and discuss The Prophets. If you wouldn't mind starting our listeners off with a brief synopsis of The Prophets, that would be great.
Sure. The Prophets is a story about Samuel and Isaiah, two enslaved young men on a plantation in Mississippi during the antebellum period. But what marks them as different is that they are in love. And the book revolves around how that love affects everyone around them, whether enslaved or enslaver. And all of that leads to a pretty chilling climax.
Okay. The story starts not so much at a beginning, right? But at a crossroads. And Samuel and Isaiah have already been inseparable for years, so much so that they're referred to as the two of them.
Yes.
But at no point as the reader was I unconvinced of their history as individuals, but also as their years-long love for each other. And I'm just curious about how you balanced the present story with each of the characters' pasts.
That was the difficult work.
Yeah.
The entire book actually began from a place of character. The first character I imagined was called Hannibal and eventually became Isaiah. And once I realized pretty early on that the true core of this story, the true drive of it, is the love between Isaiah and Samuel, that led me to the decision to make sure that not only were Samuel and Isaiah developed full dimensional in really human ways, but that the people around them who will be witnesses to their love also had to be full round dimensional human beings. And their interactions drove everything from structure to plot. Like, the entire thing is because of how these characters interacted with one another, saw one another, thought about themselves. And in that is where I found the richness of how to sort of depict Samuel and Isaiah and their love for one another, and how to make it feel as though it sprung up out of nature, because that is essentially what it does. The moment they see each other, they instinctively know there's something about that other person that I want to be close to. I don't have the words yet because I'm still a child, but there's something just amazing about this person and I want to be in their presence. And that is, in some ways, how I came to my own sexuality. Is I was very young. I was like maybe 3 or 4 years old when I knew that I liked boys. I didn't have words or language or anything for it, but I remember that feeling of what it felt like to be in the presence of somebody that I now know I had a crush on, even though I was so young. And so I tried to remember that as deeply as I possibly could and replicate it in their meeting as well.
I love everything about that description. Did you always intend to tell the story from so many points of view and timeline?
I did not start out telling this story from multiple points of view. My initial intention was to tell this story only from Isaiah's point of view as a fictionalized slave narrative. But I kept running into roadblocks in terms of the amount of information I could put into it if I'm only telling it from Isaiah's perspective. And so then I said, okay, well, I'll tell it from Isaiah and Samuel's perspective because, you know, they are the two in love. Realized rather quickly that that was still limiting. And then said, okay, the core of the story is their love and that love needs witnesses. And so I need to let these others have their perspectives. And how I determined which others would have their perspective is because I would run into something like, well, what would a plantation owner think about two enslaved young men in love? Well, then maybe I should let him tell us what he thinks. And so from questions came these other character perspectives. And then I had a dream where a sentence came to me, "You do not yet know us." And I realized that not just these characters needed to have their voice, but an ancestral voice needed to be present. And I started to write from the ancestral point of view, sort of guiding the reader, but also the other characters and even me as the writer through this narrative. And that is what actually led me back to the sort of time before in Africa, where Samuel and Isaiah have a precursor in Kosai and Alewa to sort of show that Black queerness is not something that is a result of trauma, which some people believe it is, that the enslaved Black person was forced to do depraved things and that's why we're queer, but that it was something that was part of the landscape of many, many African societies. And that was sort of my way to sort of display and show that.
And so normalized.
Yeah.
Which I love about it. And I was so struck by all of the different perspectives in the prophets, but not just that, but how each section was broken up in a way that resembles a book of worship or the Bible. Aside from the overarching story itself, how did you go about organizing your thoughts and organizing the book?
You know, it took me 14 years to write this book.
Oh my word.
Wow.
It shows.
Thank you. It is a labor of love.
I started I was thinking about it in my final semester of undergrad. This was in 2006, but I was afraid to even really give it my full sort of imagination because I thought, one, people would think it was far-fetched. Two, I can't find any examples of this in the literature, and so I'll have to completely imagine it. Three, I think I'll get a lot of pushback from particular members of particular communities who don't believe that Black queerness existed in the in antiquity, that it was just, you know, a modern invention, so to speak. So I kind of brushed it to the side. But then in my first semester of grad school in September, October of 2006, one of my instructors, Stacey DeRasmo, gave the class an assignment in fiction tutorial. And she said, go out into the world and find an object, a character you're thinking about might possess. And because New York City is what it is, I found a pair of shackles in the garbage.
Wow.
That's on the street. Wild.
Can you even imagine? I don't know the story of those shackles, why they were there, but they were like on the ground by the black garbage bags waiting to be picked up by sanitation the next morning. And I picked them up and I took that as my sign that this character wanted me to tell their story. And so I did. And quickly realized it was so much bigger than just one character, and it all had to come together in this way. And it was taking me so long because I was dedicated to doing research, to finding any hints of Black queerness in a time prior to the Harlem Renaissance, because that's the earliest I could find it. Wallace Thurman writing in 1929, The Black of the Berry, is the earliest reference I could find. Other than Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, Harriet Jacobs talks about it in the context of rape or sexual assault, as does Toni Morrison in Beloved. But Toni Morrison also said, if you cannot find the book you wish to read, then you must write it.
Right.
And so I started doing it, terrified, but I did it, and it took me 14 years to get to what you have in your hands as the prophets.
We interviewed a historian, Blair Amani, last year, and she was talking about how it was really important to her to capture things in history because we kind of learn from Black history, like slavery ended, and then in school, the next thing you hear about is the civil rights movement. And this struck me in so much the same way of, you know, obviously, sexuality is a spectrum. It is now, it always has been. These stories had to be somewhere, but we had not heard them. And it's so interesting that you were concerned about being far-fetched because it was so richly developed and the various perspectives and the timeline and the way it all came together, I felt so enmeshed in it that it had to be real.
Thank you for saying that, because that was a tremendous worry of mine that it would come across as unbelievable.
Wow.
But I'm glad that you felt some authenticity to it, because I tried very hard to be as authentic as I possibly could. And what was interesting was that when I started this book, there were no references I could rely on. But as I began to write it, so I'm moving like maybe 3-4 years into the writing process, I started to find things in the time before in Africa. Esther Arma, who is a brilliant artist activist from Ghana, talked about how from her cultural perspectives, there was not even a need to give homosexuality a name because it was considered such a normal part of existence that why would you need to distinguish it? And I found that so many other African cultures took that same sort of perspective, that it was nature. And that it's not until Christian missionaries came into their villages and their towns and their cultures, that it began to take over and be presented as this idea that, oh, this is disgusting or this is sinful. And so that was someplace I found a foundation. And quite late into the process of me writing this book, we discovered a person named William Dorsey Swan, who was an enslaved man who became America's very first drag queen. Hmm. So that was quite like a sort of a, there you go. You have the proof that you need. It's the evidence you need that this is not made up. It's not a figment of your imagination. These stories have just been ignored or erased.
Sorry, Jill and I can see each other on our iPads. We just keep staring at each other with like big eyes and chills down our spines.
It's true. I'm wondering though, if we can talk for a little bit about those chapters that are set in Africa. I loved how as a reader, we were suddenly plunged not only into a different setting, but a space where gender pronouns were chosen by the characters as a representation of their inner self. And I'm just so curious, like Michael and I were talking, I said, oh, I started reading it and I made my, assumptions and then realized I was wrong and had to go back. And, it so deepened my reading experience. And mm-hmm. I'm curious if you can, share a little bit about how those came to be.
Sure. During the, process of researching, particularly the African parts of the novel, I read about so many different African cultures and peoples who had such marvelously modern ways of thinking about gender identity and sexuality. Things that here in the West, we're just coming to these understandings, but that these were their indigenous beliefs from thousands of years ago. And so I encountered quite a number where king was just a title, and whoever was the leader of the group was king,
whether
they were male, female, or other. And these women-led societies, or these places like there's one tribe called the Dagara tribe, which they live in the area now known as Burkina Faso. And for them, they were super excited whenever queer people were born into their group, because they felt like, oh, finally, we have guardians for the gates. Because in their spiritual system, they believed the queer people were the ones who not only were groomed to guard their villages, but to also guard the gates between the here and the hereafter. So ancestrally, it was it was a rejoicing when they were born. So I was learning about all of these different ways these different African cultures thought about queer people. And I said, oh, this is so rich. I'm going to incorporate bits and pieces of this. I'm going to develop a fictional tribe called the Kasongo people. And I'm going to imbue them with all of these bits and pieces of information that I'm learning, so that it presents itself as a full contrast to what we understand as the binaries in the West, to show that, because for one, I thought how I was raised to think about gender and sexuality was universal, that the whole world thought of it in the same way that I thought of it, and then came to find out that no, this construction that we learned in the West is just that, a construction, and it is not how everyone in the world thinks about these things. And so I wanted to show that sort of juxtaposition between prior to Western interference and after Western interference, and what that looks like.
Yeah. And like the sort of happening as we're reading it, the interference, we experience the interference as we're reading it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That was really amazing. I want to go back to character a little bit. And you mentioned that Isaiah, by another name, is who came to you first.
Yes.
And I just love how this book is, it is about Isaiah and Samuel, and so much of it is about them through other people's perspectives. And some people just come in for one chapter and then their perspective never comes back, but their presence has equal weight. And I have to imagine that was probably kind of difficult to keep track of. And just curious, after Isaiah, who came to you and how did you go about organizing each of the characters and their perspectives?
After Isaiah, who started out as Hannibal, Simon came to me, who eventually became Samuel.
Okay.
And then after Samuel, it was Haggai, who eventually became Maggie. Mm. And that was the Holy Trinity, so to speak.
Yeah, that feels right.
they were the three that I knew would guide me to where I needed to go. In fact, Maggie, and I've heard Toni Morrison say this about one of her characters, Pilot in Song of Solomon. Mm-hmm. Maggie threatened to take over the book. She was the one that was talking to me the most, the one that I felt most comfortable writing, who just felt like she needed more time on the page. And nearly, there are actually chapters sitting on my office floor where I had to take Maggie out.
Really? Because
it was becoming a Maggie book.
Mm. If Maggie got a spinoff, I would definitely read it.
Yes, I love Maggie.
She is a fan favorite, certainly. A lot of readers really, really like Maggie.
Yeah.
And I really, really like Maggie as well. And so when I'm sitting down thinking about each of these characters, whether it's Samuel and Isaiah and Maggie, or even Paul, Ruth, and Timothy, I'm trying my best to let them tell me who they are, whether I like or dislike what they're telling me.
Right.
In fact, there were so many times I was trying to make Samuel a nicer person and he resisted it. He kept saying, no, that's not who I am. And I actually let him include that in the novel. Parts I'll say, wait, that's a lie, you know, because that is how he spoke to me. And so I just let him speak. And that was the process of listening. So most of the time that I wrote this novel, I was writing during the magic hour or the witching hour, 3 a.m. I would wake up 3 a.m., come into my office to write, because that was the time when New York City, Brooklyn was the most quiet. It was also the time where you could hear those ancestral voices most clearly. And so some of the time I'm guiding it. Like, I know what I'm writing. I'm sitting at the computer and I say, okay, this is what I need Samuel to do here. And then in other moments, it's almost like I'm a conduit for something else. And I'm almost letting my subconscious or whatever in the ether take over to write what needs to be written. And then, because there are times now when I go back to the novel to read a part, to decide what part am I going to read for a particular interview. And I'll read a passage and I say, wow, I don't even remember writing that.
Wow.
I like it, but I don't remember writing it. And those are those, what my husband calls head in the clouds moments, where you let whatever artistic spirit is speaking to you take over. And so that's what I did for all the characters. I knew who they were supposed to be, but I also let them tell me who they needed to be.
That rings so true. I love what you say about Samuel, and that there was a moment after the scene between Timothy and Samuel when Samuel, a tear sort of escapes his eye, but he refused to acknowledge or to wipe it away, because I would acknowledge that it was even there. And I thought that was one of the best aspects of a person's character that I've ever read, because it just rang. That was near the end of the book, and that rang so true who I knew Samuel to be, or to have told me who he is at that point. I loved that detail.
Oh, thank you. I wanted in that scene to ensure that Samuel recognized that his action, though he thought it was justified, he also understood how it diminished him to do it.
Yeah.
And so how do I say that without saying it? How do I show it? And so that is how I allowed him to show it.
I'm just going to reveal some behind the scenes here. Jill and I filled like two documents worth of like quotes from the book that we wished to read to you, but we're not going to do that because that would be...
We really did.
It would just be like stupid.
It's a whole page single space. Yeah.
Oh, but I did want to say, I loved where you went with Adam at the end of the book and his feelings of being split in two. Oh. And I couldn't like walk away from this interview without, I have no question or anything here. I just want to say like, I loved that detail as well.
Adam is legitimately one of my favorite characters in the book who spoke to me most readily, who it almost felt like he sat down in front of me and said, please tell my story. Like it felt like he was the kindest to me. He was the most, he's the one that laughed with me. He's the one who did not judge me, he was the one who was most confident in me that I could tell his story in a way that he would be pleased with. That's what it felt like writing about Adam. And so many things came to me so easily when I was writing him that I started to love him as I was writing it. I was like, I love this character. I wish I could give him more time. And I wish that his ending would not be as tragic as it would be.
Yeah.
But he told me this is how it had to end for him. Adam is one of, I think, one of the most fascinating characters in this book.
I love him.
To me as the writer.
Yeah. Speaking of endings, and I don't want to spoil anything, something that resonates throughout the book that you kind of remember to keep in mind as a reader is Isaiah's want for knowledge of his name. I'm going to try not to cry. I loved that exploration of person so much. And I was just curious if you could talk to us and our listeners a little bit about that journey for Isaiah.
Yeah. I knew as soon as there's an opening chapter. It's actually the second chapter before we get to Samuel and Isaiah, where it's Isaiah's mother talking. Mm-hmm. And she lets us know right off the bat the name that she and her husband gave him. And he knows for some reason, because he has some recollection of his parents, that his name isn't Isaiah, because obviously they didn't start calling him that until he reached empty. Mm-hmm. So he remembers he has another name, but he doesn't know what it is. And what that represents is the way in which enslaved Africans, Black people, have been stripped of who they are in order to become this other thing in the eyes of the people who enslaved them. So whether that was, we're going to drag you from your people, put you on these ships, bring you to a strange new land, which we stole from these other people, and give you Christian names such that you will never remember the names you were given by your own spiritual practices and cultures as a means to subjugate you. We will not even let you know what your date of birth is. You will be forbidden from reading and writing. We want you to so not know who you are. We want to turn you into a slave, which is a non-person. Isaiah intuitively knows that he is not a slave. He knows that he is a person, and he's trying to refill himself with the things that this place emptied out of him. And that is, you know, part of the reason why the enslaved people there call it empty, because that is what it does. It empties you out, but not just the enslaved, also the enslaver, because that you have to be emptied of your humanity in order to do this to someone else. Mm. So Isaiah's journey is the journey of rediscovering who you actually are, such that you can never be diminished by anyone else again. But also the realization is that you were never the one that was diminished. It was the person trying to diminish you.
Yeah.
I hear birds chirping.
That's my window.
It's so lovely. I love it.
We mentioned at the top that you're the creator of a social justice community, Son of Baldwin. Can you talk to us and our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. So I'm a bit of a late bloomer. I did not return to college until I was 31 years old. I had attempted to do it. Well, first I should say I dropped out of high school because I was a bullied kid because people detected my queerness and they wanted to remind me of how awful they thought it was. So I dropped out of high school, got my GED, worked for a little bit at Toys R Us, and then went to college. My first semester was in 1992 when I was 21 years old. Did really well the first semester, but not so well the second because I didn't really know why I was there other than you're supposed to go to college after high school. Attempted again later on to go to college and that didn't work out. And then finally, because of watching the Oprah Winfrey Show, I totally discovered that my purpose was writing. It was something that I tried to deny my whole life because I had been told that it's not where you make money and I needed to get a job with benefits and a good retirement pension plan. And so that was what I was seeking when what I should have been seeking was my purpose. And I went back to college at 31 and was introduced to James Baldwin that very first semester and was immediately enamored with him because he was Black, queer, a man, a writer from New York City, all of the things I was or wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so I became obsessed. And I started reading all of his work and was wondering at the time why he wasn't as celebrated in the culture as he is now. And I said, in around 2007, 2008, I said, I'm going to start a blog called Son of Baldwin, where we discuss all of these things that James Baldwin discussed. And we talk about his work and all of that. And around 2008 is when Facebook went from just for college students to sort of the broader public. And so I moved it from Blogspot to Facebook. And that is when it started to grow. And so the original intention of it was to celebrate Baldwin in all the subject matter he talked about. And it grew into a celebration of all things Black LGBTQIA+. And it's been in existence since then. And I've learned such a great deal from it, having connected to people from all around the world, Zimbabwe, Brazil, Nigeria, Great Britain, Canada, all of these places. And it has been trying at times because it is a magnet for people who would like to troll or who are against the idea of Black people or LGBTQ plus people having rights. But it has also been incredibly enlightening and had a really tremendous positive impact on my writing of The Prophets in terms of making sure that it was as inclusive as I could possibly make it.
It's interesting you say that because you're so right. In the last 5 to 10 years, James Baldwin has become so much more a part of the cultural zeitgeist. And when that happens, it's easy to forget that that wasn't always the case. Right. And it's just interesting to hear how that's spun from a need for you into this unbelievable community. And also that the social media aspect of it is equal parts awesome and great, and also like super trolly and terrible. And navigating those two things is the worst.
it really is. There's this quote: "We can disagree and still love each other, unless your disagreement is rooted in denial of my humanity and right to exist." Everyone thinks James Baldwin said that, but I actually said it. But because I said it under the moniker of Son of Baldwin, everyone thought, Son of Baldwin is just quoting James Baldwin. And so they assigned it to him. Like, I think Vanity Fair was the first to say, as James Baldwin said. And so now I'm constantly fighting when people say that. And I'm like, no, actually, I said that. And they're like, you're lying. You're plagiarizing James Baldwin. And I said, please find the quote where James Baldwin said that prior to 2015, when I said it in this tweet here, and they can never find it. So they wind up apologizing.
Oh my gosh.
And but you know what? It's such a compliment that someone thinks that something I said, James Baldwin said.
Absolutely. Circling back to the prophets, so much of the book was very direct in its descriptions of the brutality of slavery. Yet the ending that you chose was ultimately hopeful. Mm. I'm curious what drove that decision.
You know, it was the fact that I'm here, which meant that my ancestors survived, which meant they had to hold on to some vestige of hope in order to do so. And I was obsessed with trying to determine what vestige of hope that could have possibly been. And I was talking to another interviewer, and Danielle Moody, as a matter of fact. And I said, I think they did it because they dreamed that maybe one day we would be here, able to tell their story, able to live a life different from the lives they had to live, such that they recognized that their sacrifices, the horrors they endured, were not in vain. And so to honor that, I had to make sure that, yes, I have to describe it as it was. And these were horrors that were inflicted upon my ancestors, utter horrors. Some of the things that I learned in my research broke me down into pieces. But I also had to ensure that I paid homage to the fact that they endured all of it so that I could be here to talk about it. And talk about it in a way that was more theoretical than experiential. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say that one of the other lessons I learned in writing this book was how little things have actually changed in these hundreds of years. Because so we're not on cotton plantations being forced to pick cotton, but the prison industrial complex essentially does the same thing.
Yeah.
And while we're not being whipped by plantation overs and overseers, we still just watched a video of a cop kneeling on a Black man's neck relentlessly on camera without compunction. So overseer, officer, plantation, prison industrial complex, these things are the same. Mm-hmm. They've morphed a little bit so that they suit our sensibilities as quote unquote contemporary modern people. Mm. But the underlying animus, the underlying bigotry and hatred, the underlying horrors still exist. But when I see the young people on the streets demanding their rights, pushing back against all odds against these horrors, that's the hope. And I had to pay homage not just to the ancestral hope, but the hope of this new generation who refuses to submit to these travesties.
That it was, as a reader, just deeply emotional to get there in the book. And I would have, this is where we just praise the hell out of our authors. Endless good word has come from this. It is, the prophets is getting so much positive praise and feedback. And I'm just curious, a book that came out in quarantine, your debut novel, also getting just like all of the accolades it totally deserves. Are you just like so overwhelmed?
Honestly, Michael, I was shocked. Oh. Like utterly shocked. Like I'm still sort of in a state of disbelief where whenever I hear something good about it, it's happening to some other person named Robert Jones that I'm watching and saying, oh, good for him. I can't internalize it because I had prepared myself for 14 years for people to hate it. So if I read a review that's not so kind, that almost feels legitimate to me. Mm. And then when I read the reviews that praise it, I feel not worthy. I don't know what to do with that, other than to say that I'm trying to receive the good things that people are saying about it, because I'm one of those people who, as an artist, I'm constantly critical of myself. So when I'm writing, I'm constantly rewriting, because this is the horror of being a writer. You're always better tomorrow than you are today. So you're constantly revising it because what you wrote yesterday is not as good as what you're thinking right now. And so if it wasn't for my editor, Sally Kim, and my literary agent, PJ Mark, this book would have never come out because I was constantly rewriting it. So they had to be the ones to tell me that, oh, it's okay now to let it go and to let it be published and to let it go into the world. Otherwise, I would have constantly rewrote it. So when I do hear the praise, and I'm just surprised that so much of the so many of the reviews have been positive. I'm legitimately surprised by that. But I'm thankful too.
It's amazing that you say that because Michael and I talk a lot. I called Michael. I want to say I was only maybe 30 to 50 pages into it. And I said to Michael, I'm reading it really slowly. And not because it's not well written or I'm not enjoying it. It's a book that makes you slow down and it makes you consider each sentence and each character, and you feel like they're talking to you and you want to give them the moment and you want to be present to witness what it is that they have to say to you.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those books. I'm kind of a chronic quick reader, and I loved the slowness with which I went through this book, and I loved the way the characters spoke to me. And a few more days later, I think I said, this feels like a book that has just always existed. Like, yeah. It's not a new book. It's an amazing classic that I'm reading. And I don't know. Anyway, I have no question. I'm just going to ramble and tell you how amazing I thought.
No, I felt the same way, Jill. I was consumed in the best way by spending as much time in this book as I possibly could. I squeezed as much life out of this as I could because I was like grieving the end before I got there because I just didn't want to finish it. And I'm gobsmacked that it's a debut. And I totally hear what you're saying, Robert, about, I recently heard this quote that, to write, you cannot write and judge at the same time. And, that as someone who wants to be a writer is like why I have never published anything, because I am actively judging what I'm writing while I'm writing. And I have to assume, I mean, that sounds like it was such a difficult thing, but I'm really glad that you had people in your camp that were like, this is good and it's ready for people to read it.
Yeah, because I had no sense of whether it was good or not. Sense whatsoever. PJ Mark is the first person within the industry to say, Robert, you have something here. This vision is amazing. Otherwise it would have been here on my computer and I would have been right now still looking at it and revising.
Sure.
Michael and I we are notoriously obsessed with book covers. And I was so drawn to the jacket art for The Prophets.
Yeah,
what was your reaction when you first saw it? Did you have any input or see it before it was finalized?
This is actually the second cover.
Oh. Ooh.
We had a first cover designed by the same person, Vien. And I always mess up the pronunciation of this last name. It's N-G-U-Y-E-N. And it was a river coming down the center of the book. And at first, all you see is the river. And then you realize that the river is creating two faces. And then you realize the river itself is like spirits in the water. And I was so in love with that cover. And then we found out there was a similar cover out there already. Oh. And then we were like, shoot. And so Vianne, being the genius that she is, was like, well, here's cover B. And then we looked at this and we were like, you know what? I actually like this cover better than the first one.
That's amazing.
And so the first time that I saw this unveiled was during a book expo.
Okay.
Sally Kim and I were talking via Zoom, and she goes, "Robert, I'd like to show you something." And she held it up, and I just broke down into tears.
Oh, yeah.
And so much so that that made the New York Times. Like, that moment, they talked about it on the New York Times. And so I love this cover. It, like, to me, it's so iconic.
Yeah.
Everything from the way the faces form the sky, mm-hmm. to the way the sun is either rising or setting, it's hard mm-hmm. to tell, to the way the font, like, calls back to something really deep and old. It's just so marvelous to me. And then the book itself, if you take off the jacket, it has these really ancient symbols on it. And I come to find out that these symbols have, like, African meaning. Like, I think they mean something like to gather the family, or to, you know, gather the community, or something that like that. And I was just like, oh my God, this is just layer upon layer of yeah. wonderfulness. And so I absolutely adore this cover. And Vianne is an absolute genius for designing it.
Yeah, certainly.
I'm pulling my cover off as we speak. Michael had probably already seen them.
I was going to ask him about it.
Yeah. Michael's notorious for taking the covers off.
Well, I want to preserve them. I think when they're so gorgeous, I just, like, don't want to mess them up.
Yeah.
But when I read them, I set them aside. And then when I'm done reading, I put them back on. Jill.
I just want to say that this podcast is amazing. Like, the both of you have, like, the perfect NPR voices.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to go home? You have made my day.
This is like, you've put me at such ease. Your voices, the birds in the background, the sun outside my window. I feel like this was like the perfect podcast. Like, this was so wonderful.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. You know what?
I'm going to cry.
Yeah. It's been a tough year. And I think that this has been, I'll speak for Jill as well, to say there is no such thing of silver linings in quarantine, but this, if there was one, it's this, because we have gotten to be able to talk to people like you and read such amazing books. And I think this response to it is kind of what you're saying, but in hearing people say that they loved your book, it was hard for you to believe it. I have a hard time believing that, like, anybody but my mom listens to this podcast.
Same.
So I really appreciate hearing that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's definitely been, I have four children, and they were sent home from school, you know, a year ago.
Wow.
This podcast has been like my lifeline to the outside world.
Jill, you sound so calm to have four children.
And she's not mentioning that it's two sets of twins.
Two sets of twins.
Yes.
You have to be kidding me.
No.
You better play
the
lottery.
They're perfect children. I love her kids.
Oh, you are not here with them.
No. From afar.
Jill,
what you tell me, I love.
If you don't play Powerball right now. Two sets of twins. And this podcast was almost like a meditation. It brought me such a sense of peace. Like, I feel such a sense of peace right now. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you. I don't know what to say. I'm
blushing.
Yeah, I am. This whole conversation has been so moving. Michael and I are really lucky that we have organized this in a way that we have been reaching out about books that we love. And so we never have that situation where you have to try to pretend to be more enthusiastic right. about something than you are. And the book touched me so deeply. And just now talking with you about it today and learning more about its creation has just deepened the well of it for me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so very much.
This has been so lovely. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today. You can find Robert online on Twitter at Son of Baldwin and Instagram at The Son of Baldwin. The debut novel, The Prophets, which we've had the pleasure to discuss today, is our second book club pick of 2021 and is available everywhere, but we hope that you'll pick it at our bookshop link, which is bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod. As a reminder, every purchase you make at Bookshop supports an independent bookstore in the country. We also want to thank Robert's team at GB Putnam and Sons for their support in making today's interview possible. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure and joy.
I will never forget that conversation.
I won't either. It was an honor. I mean, just
honestly,
I know I say this every time, but talking with the author always not only increases my enjoyment of the book, but you know, you send a book out into the world and it, I imagine as an author, it has to be so hard because you mm-hmm. surrender the experience of this thing that you have loved and nurtured and view in a certain way, and you have to surrender it to the masses for their thoughts and opinions and how they interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And talking with him was just so, I just felt like it enhanced everything that I knew and felt about mm-hmm. it.
Yes. And to your point, I think that it must have been really hard for Robert Jones Jr. because he spent 14 years working on this book.
I can't imagine. But I mean, it shows.
The amount of love he had for this is on every single page.
Yeah. 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 You feel like every single voice that comes to you is an actual person.
Yes. And my takeaway too from his conversation was I am unsurprised by how much people are loving this book, how glowing the reviews have been. He is just one of the most humble people I've ever had the great pleasure of talking to, because he was just saying like, it's continues to be hard for me to believe that readers are loving it, that critics are loving it. And again, I think that goes back to kind of something that we talked about in our book club chat. And also what we talked about with Robert was this wasn't a book that had been out before, a perspective that we had never read, that he had never read. And he had spent over a decade working on it. I understand that it would be very hard to believe people having such an impact on it when it was so personal to him for mm-hmm. so long.
Yeah, it felt like one of those books where, you know, it was a joy to read. It was an honor to talk to him. I assume this book is going to be at the top of all the best of lists awards at the end of the year. I can't imagine that it wouldn't be. And I was really struck. We read so much. I feel like and have the pleasure of being aware of so much and reviews and stuff. Right. I feel like I tend to get better books on a pretty good average. If I'm happy with 75% of what I read, I feel like I'm having a great year. Something about 2021, I have not read a stinker yet.
Me neither. I'm actually getting nervous about it.
Right? It's
like, I'm not going to have a top 10. I'm just going to have, every book I read in 2021 was the best book I read in 2021.
Yes, exactly.
I agree. I've been overwhelmed in the best way with it. And I think it's because, or I don't know why, but it is something I didn't know I needed after the year we had was just being so fulfilled in my reading so far in 2021. And at this point, we'll have had an episode air that is us doing a rewind of books that came out during quarantine that we wished had gotten more attention. And I have a feeling we're going to do the same thing for books that came out at the beginning of 2021 that just deserved more attention and more fanfare.
Yeah.
That didn't get because we were on the tail end of quarantine. And every book that I have read so far will be in that conversation. And that's including, of course, The Prophets.
Yeah. The beginning of this year has been jam-packed. But The Prophets is definitely at the top of my list. I'm just excited that we've gotten to do it for book club.
Yeah.
And had the chance to talk to Robert because it was just really meaningful for
me. Absolute, yes.
Yeah.
Career high, life high. Yeah. Actual high. It's floating on a cloud afterwards. I wasn't high. I don't know why I said that.
I was like, literal high. Okay.
Are we going? No, like on endorphins, you know, like endorphins make you happy, make you feel crazy. We love doing book club. We love getting to talk to these authors. If you haven't had time to read The Prophets, please go do so now. We have a ton of resources on our website and on our social media to help you have conversations about it with your personal book club or just for thoughts that you're having on your own as you read it. Please visit our website at bookitpod.com. If you're interested in purchasing The Prophets, it's available at our bookshop affiliate link, bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod. And reach out to us. Let us know what you thought about the book or any books that you hear us talking about on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
Book It is available across podcast platforms.
Subscribe to never miss an episode, and don't forget to leave a review before you go.
We'd love to stay in touch. You can find us online at bookitpod.com or on Instagram and Twitter at bookitpod.
Want to read something you heard on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod.
Book It was created by hosts Jill Birkett-Ragasey and Michael Woodson, with sound design and production by Madeline Call at Honeysuckler.